thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a biweekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus 21 for the 13th of February, 2008. To read or not to read. I'm Dan Cohen. Welcome, listeners, new and old, back to the Digital Campus podcast. We're here, as usual, with our regulars around our virtual roundtable, here with Mills Kelly. Mills, hi.
Hey, Dan. How are you today?
Pretty good. And Tom Scheinfeld. Hi, Tom.
Good to talk to you, Dan.
Good to talk to you. Well, I guess we're going to jump right into the news roundup, and I suppose we need to maybe say a few words about the possible impact of the Microsoft Yahoo story. Of course, Microsoft offering $44 billion to buy out Yahoo. Obviously, this is a business story. This is a tech story. Is there any angle here or importance for academia or museums and libraries to this union? Should it go through, or if it doesn't go through? Tom, what are your initial thoughts after seeing this story come out?
Well, earlier last week, I was thinking that, it was definitely going to go through. I couldn't see why Yahoo wouldn't. Now it looks like they're looking for more money. I guess I would say that it is probably an important story if it happens for higher ed, just in that I think that there needs to be a competitor to Google. I mean, Google's doing amazing things right now, and I am, bought into the Google suite of technologies. I'm using Gmail. I'm using Google Docs. Google's my primary search engine. I use a lot of the Google products. But with Microsoft 10 years ago, I think having a viable competitor in the web services realm is important to the internet in general, but to higher education users in particular. As we've said this before, as universities and other institutions start looking at using things, for instance, like Gmail instead of their own homegrown email servers, as they start looking into Google Docs as a collaborative environment for their students and for the work of museums and libraries. I think it's important to have a competitor to that. And Microsoft hasn't been able to be a viable competitor. Yahoo has put out some really great products and has actually been able to incorporate some great products like Flickr and Delicious into its stable of technologies. But neither of them have really been able to compete with the onslaught of Google. And I think this is an opportunity for that. These are two giant companies, and we'll see if it works, and we'll see if it even happens. But if it does, I think it's a good thing.
Mills, what were your initial thoughts on hearing about this alliance?
I guess I sort of had the same opinion as Tom in that it's not going to make that big of a difference one way or another for higher education, except that I have one kind of personal concern, and that is I'm a big Flickr user, and I've written a good bit about Flickr in my blog, in particular a recent post about this, the Flickr Commons alliance with the Library of Congress. And Microsoft is an increasingly bureaucratic organization, at least from the outside looking in. And so I would worry that some of those kind of exciting fringe developments around the edges of Yahoo's core business would get lost in this merger if it happened. So, but that's I guess my really only significant concern.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't think it had a lot of applicability to higher ed until, I started thinking more along the lines of, Tom, what you were speculating about web applications and services. And, also knowing that Microsoft has indeed, I think, recently tried to start matching Google on the, sort of Google Apps for Education, at least in terms of their email systems. I think you can now get a similar deal, sort of free deal for some kind of Microsoft Mail for campuses. And, you know, but then spreading that out a little bit, I think John Markoff had a good column on in the New York Times about this. And he actually thought, much like you, Tom, that, you know, maybe what this is while everyone's focusing on Yahoo's search business and the advertising business, which is where, you know, much of the money is right now, and certainly it's where Google is making 95% of their money, that in the long term, you know, Microsoft is looking to sort of migrate their Office suite, which is an enormous moneymaker, online. And they, of course, have Microsoft Live applications that live on the web, that are in the trendy term for cloud computing now is what it's called, and that Yahoo has 350 or 400 million users, and that they get that user base and kind of convert that user base into, you know, Microsoft Live apps, you know, Office Online rather than Google apps, that maybe that's the road forward for them, that they kind of keep this Office suite but move it on the web and then get all the Yahoo users and get a dominant position there, which has always been their cash cow. And in that case, then it really does provide a serious competition to what Google's trying to do with Google Apps. And, you know, we all use Google Apps, but, you know, Gmail is still a distant second to Hotmail and MSN, Yahoo Mail and Hotmail. They have a very, you know, strong position in email. And then, you know, Google Apps, while it certainly made inroads in among early adopters, is still, you know, most people are still using Word, and they're using it on their desktop. And I think if Microsoft can provide a seamless sort of migration path, then you've got a real competitor for, you know, especially on campuses, for sort of free apps that are probably going to be ad-supported, maybe in the long run. But it kind of provides a competitor for that market. And so I think thinking not in terms of search and advertising, but in terms of those all-important sort of Office suite applications might indeed have some kind of impact on campus. Well, the other story we were following this week, or that we always like to see every year, is the Horizon Report. And the Horizon Report comes out at the beginning of every year. It's a joint production of the New Media Consortium and the EDUCAUSE Learning Initiative. And what it does is it basically just sort of looks ahead to the coming 5 years and sort of splits out what they think is going to happen technologically on campuses in the next year, in the next 2 or 3 years, and then sort of in the long run, if we can call it that, in a 5-year window. And, you know, a lot of these key emerging technologies, as the Horizon Report makes available, by the way, we'll, of course, link to this, as always, on digitalcampus.tv, but you can download the PDF. And a lot of these prospective technologies are things that we've talked a lot about and perhaps confirms our vision of the future. But maybe we'll walk through here and see if there's any surprises. First of all, at least in the near term, they're looking at the growth of grassroots online video. And seems like a no-brainer there. And then also 1 year or less in that category are collaboration webs, which they sort of define as, you know, collaborative tools that enable, for instance, groups to edit documents online or hold online meetings. And indeed, that's just what we discussed. Does this make sense to you? Is this just the Horizon Report sort of tipping their hat toward these Web 2.0 phenomena like YouTube in the case of video, and also Google Apps? Is that what's going on with these first two?
I think the whole report is actually that. you know, I read through this when it came out, and I thought, well, this isn't I guess maybe horizon is the right term for it, because it's not all that future looking. It's what's on the near horizon as opposed to the distant horizon. What they're really talking about is things which are already pretty common, and that will, I guess, work their way into higher education to a much greater degree. So there's nothing kind of all that forward looking here. It's more like, hey, everybody, pay attention. This is already going on, and it's going to affect what's happening on your campus.
Right. I mean, I guess just to quickly look ahead here in the report, I mean, the sort of quote-unquote longer range, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 year emerging technologies are data mashups, which certainly are here and certainly anyone would consider part of Web 2.0. Collective intelligence and social operating systems. So here we've got, you know, collective intelligence. They mentioned Wikipedia, community tagging also seems a lot Web 2.0-y, and social operating systems. Maybe I didn't quite get this one, but, you know, it seems like, again, the impact of kind of the social graph, social networking is sort of having an impact here. Tom, did you agree that maybe this is just rather than a horizon, it's sort of maybe what's here and now and that we can already see?
Yeah, I do think it's that. I also think it's and I guess this is defensible because they're trying to predict the future, but it seems incredibly vague to me. And maybe this is partly because they're trying to predict the future and partly because their past predictions maybe have been a little off. But all of these things seem to me to be in some ways kind of the same thing. I mean, maybe mobile broadband is a little bit different, but collective intelligence, social operating systems, data mashups, collaboration webs, they all seem to me to be sort of a piece. And it is this Web 2.0 piece. I think, you know, in the past, last year, one of the things they had on there was virtual worlds, and that's not on there this year. And
interesting to see it drop off.
Right, and maybe they were a little too hasty in that judgment, and so this year they're pointing to things that are clearly underway and that are clearly going to have an impact over the next couple of years.
Yeah, they actually talk a little bit about virtual worlds a little deeper into the report under their category of meta trends, sort of looking further off into the future. And they actually have a more interesting way of thinking about these virtual worlds, and that's to talk about three-dimensional viewing of information. And as opposed to a virtual world environment, it's more sort of how is that information displayed, and now in a virtual world environment, it can be in three dimensions. And they talk about not only Second Life, but Open Croquet, this project coming out of Duke and UNC that's trying to do sort of an academic version of Second Life. And so at least, you know, they're still talking about it in this report, but I think they've kind of moved it further off into the future as one of those things we have to keep an eye on as opposed to something that's really going to affect us now.
Right. I think that's right. And yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, of course, this report is not necessarily for super geeky people who are all using Flickr and Delicious, et cetera. You know, it's for administrators as well and sort of people who kind of need to understand the lay of the land. And in that way, I think it does do a good job. I think it's very important that they've added mobile.
Yeah,
you know,
I agree.
Basically the smartphones thing. I think that's the big new addition with the sort of knocking virtual worlds off of, you know, maybe the top tier. You know, we've certainly covered that here on the podcast.
But I agree that this is something that, for instance, if you know, the president of our university was going to ask me, is there something I can read about new trends on the web and higher education? This is useful for that. I would point him to this. So I think it's very a very useful thing in that regard.
Right. Well, on the next podcast, maybe we'll mention, you know, on social operating systems, certainly we saw some news from Google about their sort of attempt to regenerate the social networking just with what's already on the web. And we can discuss that in greater depth since we don't have a lot of time in this news roundup. So stick with us for Digital Campus 22, and maybe we'll start there along with some of the other things that Google's done. Just one last word in the news roundup. Our favorite bill, and I'm sure the favorite bill of so many people in our audience, COA has passed the U.S. House of Representatives. This is the well-named College Opportunity and Affordability Act. How could anyone be against it? Except for that it has this piece in the bill about copyright infringement and peer-to-peer usage, and it really strongly pushes colleges and universities to basically to buy you know, replacements for peer-to-peer music sharing, which, I mean, it sort of forces them toward services like the new Napster, which isn't like the old Napster. It's a commercial service. I can't remember the other ones. Ruckus, is that the one from MTV? Or some of these other services that basically provide free music on campuses to try to prevent or to de-incentivize, is that the word, students from just grabbing it free off of peer-to-peer networks. And it's not clear to me, did anyone in this final passage of the bill, did anyone really get a sense of will there still be these financial penalties for universities that are caught with high numbers of peer-to-peer traders among the student population?
My sense is that it's still in there, and that there was, in fact, an attempt to remove those provisions from the bill by a Democrat from Tennessee named Steve Cohen. And unfortunately for many reasons, but unfortunately for higher education, the tornadoes in Tennessee struck last week, and Representative Cohen had to go home to Tennessee and wasn't able to present his amendment on at the meeting of the Rules Committee. And so it seemed like there was some opposition to it in the House, and that the leader of that opposition or one of the leaders of that opposition wasn't able to take that out. So I think it's still there. I think we're still stuck with those, and hopefully when this goes to the Senate, something changes.
Ars Technica did a little investigation of this, and they said that the staffers for some of the members of that committee said, oh, well, we're not – there won't really be financial punishments. I mean, I think the original language had them taking away, for instance, funding for student loans on campuses that were caught with a lot of peer-to-peer activity. And so they were sort of saying, well, it's still in the bill, but we're not really going to enforce it. But I don't know. It seemed like a very weak response, at least, that Ars Technica got. And I think there's still a real possibility here that this could go through with the strong language.
Well, it doesn't set my mind terribly at ease for the staffers of a committee to say, well, we're not really going to enforce it, when it's not Congress's, certainly not the staffer's job, and not Congress's job to enforce the bill in the first place. It's going to be the executive's job to enforce the bill, and it's going to be the judiciary's job to interpret that. So I if it goes through, that's a very bad thing, I think, whether Congress's intent is more benign or not.
Yeah. Okay, well, we'll keep track of the COA bill, and I'm sure mention it on subsequent podcasts if it actually gets signed into law. And we're very privileged to have a couple of guests on the podcast today for our featured story, which is about reading, digital, and otherwise. Joining us on the podcast are Sunil Iyengar from the National Endowment for the Arts. Hi, Sunil.
Hi, Dan. How are you?
Good. Welcome to the podcast. Thanks for joining us.
No problem.
And Matt Kirschenbaum from the University of Maryland. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Dan.
Well, welcome. And we also have Tom Scheinfeld on the line, and Mills Kelly has had to go off and teach, but he may join us momentarily, so I'll toss him into the conversation if need be. So we wanted to discuss the report that came out from NEA, and this report was about reading, or the lack thereof, in modern American society, and particularly among the younger crowd, those in the K-12 group, and even beyond. But I thought maybe we'd start with Sunil. Maybe if you, some people in our audience might not have read the report, and maybe for just a couple minutes, do you want to summarize what you feel were the main points of the report for our audience?
Thanks, sure. Sure, I'd be glad to. So this report is called To Read or Not to Read, A Question of National Consequence. And it's really a compilation of data on reading, that is to say voluntary reading, non-required reading, that is to say non-required for work or school, reading of virtually any type. It really started from a study we did several years ago on the reading of literature and the reading of books. And while literature was not attached to a specific format other than, one could, for example, read a poem online or a short story online or in print, we did ask about the number of books read over a period of a year. And we found that there were significant declines in the amount of reading that was going on compared with previous years that we've done this survey. We've done it every year since 1982. So in the wake of that, a major concern for our agency and for a lot of our partners and people in the community, in the arts organizations, but of course those in education, has been how is this trend of reading less, is it seen extensively throughout various other types of studies, as well as what are some of the implications of this, and to what degree is it truly significant? Well, to answer that pretty formidable question, we looked at a series of federal, nonprofit, academic, some industry studies with the criteria that they all had to be large and nationally representative. So we, having looked through the data, we came up with three central conclusions. The first is that, unfortunately, Americans are spending less time reading, but that's particularly the case with young adults and with teenagers. We also find that reading comprehension skills are eroding, and this is a very serious finding because the Department of Education has noted this, both of the adult population as well as some of the teenager groups we're talking about. Finally, we found some striking statistical links and correlations between reading frequently and reading well, and also reading well and reading frequently on the one hand, and some very positive individual and social outcomes on the other hand that we could discuss if you'd like. So those are really the three conclusions, which is very hard to generate, as you know, probably when you have very discordant data sources. But we were, you know, to some degree gratified that we could synthesize the results
right
into this report.
Well, just maybe one point of clarification for our audience, since our audience is a sort of digitally savvy one. It was a little unclear, to what extent digital reading was in fact covered. What's your sense of if you want to summarize for us, sort of how many of these national studies you looked at included some kind of breakout for digital reading, and sort of how much you took this into account, for instance, the example you mentioned about reading a poem online, that kind of thing.
Sure. So as with any, you know, literature review or study, meta study, you're really bound to the data and the questionnaires that have already been written and that have been provided for the surveys that we were gathering. In other words, we couldn't go back, obviously, and change the information that was collected. However, in the majority of these studies, so to answer your question, really about a couple of dozen, up to 40 or so studies figured in some way in this report. I would say close to a dozen were central to the report, and the majority of those stemmed from the Department of Education, the Kaiser Family Foundation, the Department of Labor, and a couple of other sources, U.S. Census Bureau sources. Now, with the exception of our own study, the one I referred to at the beginning, where we were really, as an arts agency, concerned about literature, we focused on literary reading, and we defined that as reading a poem, a play, or a short story, or novel. We didn't specify the medium, but when interviewers were asked, does online count, they were told to say yes. But they didn't specify for every single question reading online or in print. Now, that's one. That was a limitation there. But with every single other study cited, we are talking about reading of any type whatsoever. So the question, standard question is, how much did you read for fun this week? Or how much did you read for pleasure? Now, it is up to the survey respondent to interpret that question. You know, when they're asked that, ideally, if they consider what they do reading, if they're reading a book or reading a chapter or reading a blog even, they should be answering accordingly. Now, we hope to refine our own internal data collection to more, if I could say more specifically, kind of adumbrate what is, what we're talking about with electronic reading. But we also do footnote some studies that have been done with online reading specifically, and there haven't been too many to our knowledge. It seems there's still a murky line between reading in print and reading online. And so, in a sense, the study sort of skirted that problem because the studies, the surveys themselves, were focused on reading of any type, in any genre, in any format.
Yeah. Okay.
I think that murkiness is part of what's significant about our contemporary moment, because when we talk about reading a newspaper, often just in casual conversation, we don't even bother to distinguish anymore whether we've read it online or whether we've read the hard copy. The same goes for magazine articles that we might read, or all different kinds of media. One thing that I've noticed that was a concern to me in chapter 3 of the report, where you look at the breakout of how people are spending their leisure time, and you look at the different sources, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the Michigan study, the Kaiser, all of them differentiate explicitly between reading and then something that's usually described as computer use or computer activities. And the implication that follows then from the data is that what we do when we're spending time with a computer online is something other than reading. Reading remains a separate category. And that, to me, suggests that the way in which we're talking about online reading really hasn't been sufficiently conceived.
No, I know what data you're referring to. That's the way the U.S. Department of Labor statistics, for example, just to give you an example, they ask about, and this is what you're referring to, Matt. They ask about reading for leisure reading, how much is being done, and they ask the individual to keep track of that in a time diary. Separately from that, they do ask about games and computer use. Now, in their definition, games can include hopscotch. Computer use could include reading, or it can include other activity. But talking with the Department of Labor researchers, they believe that the reading, and this is something that I would agree with you, that we need to revisit how we define some of these computer activities. But they are hoping reading is discrete enough and separate enough to encompass what people consider they're doing on the computer when it is in fact reading. As we know, the computer can be used for multiple things, not just skimming, much less reading. I would tend to agree that category is insufficient right now. But I just want to point out that what we're seeing is really an aggregate. And I know you understand this, but it's important to kind of explain that various studies, so for example, the Kaiser one too, their whole concern was multitasking, and all these studies have different intents. Like this one was looking at multitasking in media, and they found that, for example, 20% of the time spent reading anything of any type is done, this is among 7th to 12th graders, done using a computer in addition to reading, which is when the computer is not the primary purpose. In other words, you're not reading on the computer in that case, or watching TV, or instant messaging, texting, or emailing when that's a separate activity from what they were supposed to be reading in their minds. So there's some perception problems here, clearly, and I do think survey methodologists can do a better job in time of refining this. One last thing about this I just want to throw out there, because this is frequently asked and it really dovetails with this, is there are a couple of statistics, at least in, I think it's on page 42 of the report, where we talk about online reading exclusively, and that was because of the high school survey of student engagement, which found that 71% of high school students in 2004 read online for 0 to 3 hours per week, and then a year later that had climbed to 84% of them reading 0 to 3 hours a week. Therefore, you're having less people in that group reading more than that. I agree with you. There's this more complex issue. I just would say there are a lot of indicators showing that reading as a whole, however, if one just defines it as reading in an absolute sense, it seems to be diminishing.
And we're talking about it in an absolute sense, or are we talking about leisure reading in particular?
Oh, yes. Because, important distinction. Yeah.
Because I know, like, for instance, just in my own my own career, even. I know when I first started out, it was sort of the mid-90s, at work, I spent a lot more time on the phone doing, just conducting business. And now at work, the way I stay in touch with most of my colleagues is through email. And so I'm doing, I would say on a daily basis, a lot more reading and writing than I had done probably at the beginning of my career. But it's not necessarily, it's this kind of email activity, which is somewhat different than I think what you're talking about in the study.
To me, the whole definition of reading is really crucial to what we're talking about. And I don't think it's easy or self-evident. This is where I think a historical perspective becomes helpful, because once you start to delve into the history of the book and the history of reading and you take that long view, in some ways, the conversation that we're having today, it's the kind of conversation that's happened many times before. And the irony is that there have been anxieties, both that people are reading too much or that people haven't been reading enough. And, if you go all the way back to the etymology of to read, legere from the Latin, this is a point that a scholar named Bill Sherman makes in a book on Renaissance reading and how readers in the early modern period read in a very interactive way by marking up their books and essentially talking back to them. But Sherman points out that in the original usage of the verb and the etymology of the word, reading included gathering, it included choosing, it included overhearing, even stealing, wandering, and tracking. It was really, it was a much more inclusive activity than simply consuming text. It was related to observation. And that, to me, sounds more like the kind of reading that we're now doing once again online.
So, Matt, is it... I mean, to summarize your critique, then, is your concern about the sort of mythologizing of some kind of armchair reading from the 20th century?
I think so. And this is, you know, I often think in terms of visual imagery, and this is why the photography then that accompanied the report struck a chord in me, where you have pictures of solitary readers. And we know historically that the look of reading has changed over time. In other words, how reading is represented visually, pictorial, that matters, and that tells us something about how we understand the activity of reading. There's actually a book. It's a great coffee table book. I recommend it. It's by Garrett Stewart. It's called The Look of Reading, and it simply gathers together drawings, paintings, photographs of people reading. And what immediately becomes apparent is just the variety of different social situations, the variety of different environments, postures in which people are reading. And so to me, what we tend to, I think, feel anxious about in our own present moment is the increasing loss of a certain kind of reading. That deep immersive reading that's typified by the stereotypical image of the reader under a tree. And I think that what we fail to recognize sometimes is the extent to which that is very much an idealistic image. It's a historically constructed, a historically specific image of reading. People did not always read that way. Again, if we come back to the example of the Renaissance reader, very aggressively marking up the text, or even earlier than that, medieval readers who would read out loud and read to groups of people, and so the act of reading was very much one of conversation.
I completely agree with that. I mean, just philologically, as you're saying, there's a great amount of history here to mine in the way that the book is portrayed. And not to speak for our art director, but, you know, we were just simply looking for pictures that were aesthetically, we didn't have to crop, you know, that fit into the pages.
Right.
But I can tell you, you know, I mean, what you're saying, I just would argue that we still believe, though, from the research that the digital media don't have an exclusive right to that solitary effect. And I know you're not necessarily saying that either. In other words, I believe, like you're saying, people still can mark up books. You can, mm-hmm. We're not trying to preserve the fetish or the, you know, the artifact of the book at the expense of everything else. We're just saying that we do have these strong correlations between reading and with for example, how well people read, how often people read. I would wager all of you are fairly frequent readers. However we might define it, because I think we would have the commonality that you read deeply, you think deeply, and you write about these issues. Now, we can't get everyone there necessarily, but I do think it's helpful to have that as a goal. And certainly reading in the conventional sense has proven, reading of books is not a hindrance in that way. There's certainly some great opportunities to engage on the internet, to interact as we are doing just now. But that's a slightly different form of interaction, I would argue, than one's writing and reading in a long form and then sharing it, with more written critiques added onto it. And I think that's being done on the internet too.
Okay. Go ahead, Matt.
I was just going to share a quick quotation, if I could. This is from 1859, published in Christian's Penny Magazine, an item that appeared there. And the piece reads as follows. It's a news item. A whole family brought to destitution has lately had all of its misfortunes clearly traced by the authorities to an ungovernable passion for novel reading entertained by the wife and mother. The husband was sober and industrious, but his wife was indolent and addicted to reading everything procurable in the shape of a romance. This led her to utterly neglect her husband, herself, her 8 children. One daughter, in despair, fled the parental home and threw herself into the haunts of vice. The house exhibited the most offensive appearance of filth and indigence, and so on. And it goes on, and lots of different things one could do with that. We could certainly talk about the way that reading has been gendered, for example, certain kinds of reading, the genre of the romance or the novel. But to me, when I hear that, it sounds so much like some of the critiques that we hear about today, for example, digital gaming, where you hear these stories about, you know, the mother. It's often the mother, so again, gender does come back into it, or the father who gets caught up in World of Warcraft or Second Life or whatever it is, and the kids don't get their supper and the house goes to ruin. The media loves those kinds of sensational stories. And again, I think when we look historically, we do very much see a certain kind of pattern and a certain set of anxieties that manifest over and over with regard to new media. And at
but
one
I would,
time,
yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm sorry,
go
ahead. Well, I agree with you to a point there. I do think that's certainly the case. There's always an anxiety with a new transference to a new medium, what are called disruptive technologies, often misleadingly. But I think at the same time, I think what I'm just trying to draw things back to, and I hope this is not outside the purview of this, but I feel that really a lot of this has to do with reading skills as well. And in other words, we're talking about the historical, as I understand it, the historical associations with reading and whether that's in fact been elevated unduly, that is to say book reading or any, you know, reading in the conventional sense. But all I'm trying to say is with statistics showing that those who read frequently tend to perform much better on reading tests, and they also tend to perform better on writing tests. And really, I don't see how in this case one can really mine necessarily that whether we're delineating that in terms of reading books or reading that online, because reading online too is included in that category of reading. If one reads frequently and reads widely online, then they will do presumably much better in these measurable outcomes than those who don't. And in fact, we see that reading online is often a co-occurrence, and it goes hand in hand a lot of times with people reading conventional text. That is to say, those who read, say, for example, books or magazines also tend to read more online than those who don't read at all, of course. Right. And so I think some of this is maybe, I agree, we need to refine the way we collect a lot of this data. But I think I hear a lot of things in common that I think our study might have been misconstrued in some ways as advocating only one type of reading versus another.
Sunil, maybe you could tell us a little bit. I mean, what, you know, the Tom and Matt and I all, among other things, actually teach in the classroom and have students. And what do you think the prescriptions are from this report? Is it, you know, I think a lot of people saw it as, you know, as a sort of Jeremiad. But are there prescriptions, and are there things that we can do, considering that, for instance, Matt is a owner of a shiny new Kindle? Should he be giving Kindles to all of his students? Should he be recommending they read the New York Times online? Or, is it to read offline as well? What is the point of it, you know, for teachers, let's say?
Sure.
What can we do?
Right. Yes. Maybe I can answer this through a very good piece of an observation that Matt made. I mean, I think there is a misperception that reading is a passive, maybe ivory tower type activity. And we're saying through this report, particularly in the third final section, that no, those who read often engage at higher levels in a variety of, you know, social and civic activities. And this has been not only done through our survey data, but it's been shown through Department of Education survey data, too, that those who read, obviously, a lot of this has to do with education level of their parents, their own education level, their income. But when you control for various factors such as those, you see that invariably those who read also engage more intensely in their communities. So what I would do is, I think what we would like to say is that it's really it starts with the parents, it starts with the family to you know, read in front of your kids, read to the kids, have kids read at a very early age. If they want to start reading online, great, but I would argue that one should still not lose track of the conventional methods. And then throughout time, especially when one hits 13 and goes into high school or, you know, enters that environment where there's so many competing pressures and time, considerations, that one continues to read and possibly engage in social circles through literature and through reading. And then through college and beyond, if they go to college, you would like to see communities engaged in reading and discussing things. I know that sounds like a utopia, but I feel in some ways it's no less utopic than some things we've been hearing sometimes about the great new media. I mean, I think, in other words, there's so many things we can do with what we have already, and we should bring that into the new media means and take advantage of the unique aspects and benefits of online reading. But I just think that that we would just encourage people to make reading a social and civic priority.
Matt, how would you respond to that? What do you see for the future in a world where students may be using the internet more than TV and maybe gaming more than the internet?
Yeah, I guess what I would just want to underscore is what a remarkable moment I think it is for reading. And that, to me, is part of the urgency and the excitement of this conversation. I mean, I look at the NEA report as one contribution to a discussion that also includes, for you mentioned, the Kindle, which was actually released on the same day that the report came out. I have a colleague who has vision trouble, who reads exclusively via audible.com, and they have 40,000 books online. I look at Google. They're digitizing 3,000 books a day. I look at efforts like the Open Content Alliance. So there's a remarkable amount of intensity, of thought, of creativity that's going into really reimagining the act of reading, reimagining our technologies of reading, and not just imagining, but reengineering. And that's something that we, as we know, the book, although it has not remained a completely stable platform or technology over the years, certainly this is the most sort of fundamental shift, and it's really the moment in which we're rethinking what a book is and what reading is in ways that we really haven't for a long time. And so to me, I'd spend less time worrying about the end of reading or the decline of reading than I do simply thinking about the opportunities of the present moment.
Well, Matt, Sunil, thanks so much for joining us on the podcast to discuss the report and to discuss reading in a digital forum and also in those armchairs. Thanks again to both of you.
Thank you. Thank you, too.
Thank you.
Time for Picks of the Week. I think I'm going to start this week, since I never go first, if you don't mind, Tom and Mills. And I want to start with a new part of a website for the Newseum. That's Newseum with an N at the beginning. And for those of you who haven't visited Washington, D.C., the Newseum used to be a very popular museum that was actually across the Potomac in Arlington, Virginia. And they had a museum there about the news and about journalism. And it's about to reopen after many years of it closed in Arlington, and they got a great site right off of the National Mall in Washington, D.C. with a very neat new modern building. And they're about to reopen, but they've already sort of relaunched pieces of their website. And I wanted to point to one in particular because I think it's a great example of a terrific interface that uses maps and uses sort of archival materials to, provide viewers with a kind of way of prospecting through the past and sort of through an archive in a really interesting way. So when the museum was over in Virginia, they used to have this wall called Today's Front Pages. And somehow they were able to sort of fly in overnight the newspapers from all around the United States, and they'd post them on a giant wall. And so you could kind of compare and contrast all of these big and small newspapers and what they chose to make their most important story or below the fold stories that they, wanted to cover, social issue stories and things like that. And it was a nice kind of overview of news in the United States. Well, they've now moved that online. And again, we'll have a link on our digitalcampus.tv website to this. But there's a website, part of the website at the Newseum, which is at newseum.org, where you can look at all the front pages, and they have a map, an interactive map of the United States with little dots where they have the front pages of the physical newspapers, and you kind of roll over the map, and it shows you different covers in the right side of the website. And it's just a great way as you kind of move from east to west or around a region to see, the ways in which, for instance, Super Tuesday was covered by different newspapers. I think it's a really interesting, great interface that could be used by a lot of museums and libraries that want to put their archives online. And I think it's a nice way to also do, it shows the principle of what Edward Tufte, the great interface expert, called small multiples, or the use of kind of little graphics next to each other so that, it takes advantage of the human brain's capacity to compare and contrast quickly. A nice interface over at the Newseum website. Mills, why don't we go to you next?
All right, mine is a website called Aluka, A-L-U-K-A, aluka.org. And as their website says, they're building a digital library of scholarly resources from and about Africa. And so this is an attempt to leverage lots of information from a variety, or leverage the information that a lot of different people have about Africa, both contemporary and historic, and biological as well as textual and images and that sort of thing. But what's interesting to me about this particular project is that it gets at something I've been talking about for a while, which is allowing users to tag their own various records within the database. And so they've actually, as long as you're a registered user, then you can, any item in their database, you can add your own tags to. And this is something that, we've struggled with projects like the Hurricane Digital Memory Bank and other projects that we've got about to what degree do we allow users to tag the information on our sites. And the Aluka folks, anyway, have settled on allowing people to tag whatever they want. So I went in the other day and tested out the tagging system, and it works pretty well. Their search process, just the search engine within the site, could be a little better, I think, than it is. It's not all that user-friendly, but it is nice to see a project that has pretensions of becoming a very large project starting off with allowing users to tag their own information. So it's worth checking out. I guess the only criticism I have is that this is not open to the general public for free. And the only reason I know this is because on my screen it says access provided through George Mason University. So they're somehow keying on the fact that my IP address is a George Mason University IP address. And so I get into the system that way. I suspect that if I were coming at it from home, I might not have that same access. I have to try it from home. I haven't yet.
Okay, great. Thanks, Mills. It's a really interesting site and very varied content, as you said. Tom, what do you have for us this podcast?
Well, I've got something for Black History Month, actually. It's called Amistad, the Amistad Digital Resource, and it comes out of the Columbia Center for Digital Research and Scholarship. It's a fairly traditional resource. It includes a kind of online exhibition of the history of the Civil Rights era from Brown versus Board of Education through the March on Washington and Black Power movements and to the kind of ends with the foundation of the Congressional Black Caucus. But it has the content's very rich, it's very professional, it's very well done. It has that kind of online exhibition component. And then alongside that, it has a set of maps and timelines, an image archive, an audio-video archive, a document archive, and then some glossaries of key figures, organizations, and institutions in the civil rights movement. And then it has a section for teachers where there are some document-based questions and some other learning objects for students and teachers at sort of a late high school, early college level. Very well done, very traditional site, nothing terribly revolutionary in terms of the technology, but clear, well done, and I recommend it.
Great. And, of course, we will have that link along with the other links that we mentioned on this podcast on our website, digitalcampus.tv. And feel free to surf over there to leave some comments on this podcast and prior podcasts. And, of course, feel free to email us with questions or things you'd like us to cover on future episodes. Good talking with you, Tom and Mills. I'll talk to you again in 2 weeks on another episode of Digital Campus.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do.